Catch a podcast conversations for the curious, essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. Welcome back to the deep dive. You know, have you ever been in one of those discussions about fairness, about justice, and it hits a wall because everyone seems to have a totally different idea what that even means? Yeah, whether it's something huge like a global issue or, you know, local policy or even just who gets the last piece of cake, right? It gets so frustrating. You feel kind of stuck. Well, today we're hoping to cut through some of that. We're diving deep into a really, really important work by the Nobel laureate Amartya Sen, his book, The Idea of Justice. And it's not about finding the one perfect answer. It's more about, well, finding a practical way to actually make things better, even when perfection seems, well, impossible.
Absolutely. And our sources for this dive really highlight how insightful Sen's approach is. He challenges that traditional search for, you know, the perfectly just society, the perfect institutions, this kind of grand blueprint that's often just unattainable. Instead, he points us towards something much more, well, immediate, something more impactful, looking at and trying to reduce the really clear, undeniable injustices we see right in front of us.
That sounds incredibly refreshing, actually, a different way in. So our mission today is to unpack how Sen's thinking can help us move towards a more just world without getting totally bogged down in those endless philosophical loops. So maybe let's start with the person behind the idea, Amartya Sen.
Yeah, let's do that.
I mean, the name itself carries weight, doesn't it? Nobel Prize in Economics, philosopher, former master of Trinity College, Cambridge, Harvard professor. It's quite the list.
It really is. But what makes his view on justice so unique isn't just the impressive CV. You know, it's this combination of his personal history and his incredibly wide-ranging background. He was born in Bengal back in 1933, and he actually witnessed the terrible 1943 famine firsthand. I mean, imagine that. For him, it wasn't some abstract historical fact. It was a profound lesson in how social setups, political decisions, can literally mean life or death. That kind of direct experience, seeing that level of suffering, it gives his work this empirical grounding that, you know, pure theory often lacks. He's one of those rare thinkers who genuinely bridges rigorous economics, deep philosophy, and practical fieldwork policy advice. And crucially, he draws not just from Western philosophy, but also deeply from Indian intellectual traditions. So it's a very rich mix.
Wow. Okay. So he's not just thinking in an ivory tower. He's seen the consequences, the lived reality of injustice. That makes a difference. So, given that background, how does he actually frame the core problem? How does he try to get us past those endless debates about what perfect justice is?
Well, he starts right where you did, acknowledging that frustration. How can we make the world more just if we can't even agree on the perfect ideal? It's a classic problem in philosophy. And Sen's big move, his central argument, is really a challenge to what he terms transcendental institutionalism. It's a bit of a mouthful, but basically, it's that long tradition, think John Rawls maybe, of trying to design the perfectly just set of institutions from the ground up. Sen argues, quite powerfully, I think, that searching for that single flawless blueprint, well, it often leads nowhere practical. So instead, he proposes what he calls a realization-focused comparative approach, which basically means shifting the question. Instead of asking, what does the perfect society look like? Yes, okay, between these two options, these two real-world arrangements we could have, which one is more just? Which one leads to better outcomes, less injustice? How about you? He uses this great analogy. Knowing the absolute highest, most perfect mountain in the world, that's the transcendental ideal, it doesn't actually help you choose between climbing Mount Kilimanjaro or Mount Fuji. Those are real choices, comparative ones. We don't need to agree on the absolute peak of justice to agree that, say, widespread famine or total lack of healthcare is out. Obviously unjust and needs fixing.
Yeah, and that's the key, isn't it?
No.
Shifting from this maybe unreachable ideal to, okay, what practical steps can we take now to make things demonstrably better? But if we focus on comparing options, on making things better rather than perfect, what are the challenges there? Does he talk about how we actually do that comparison?
He does, and it's really interesting. He brings in this vital distinction from ancient Indian legal and philosophical thought,
Yeah.
and the difference between niti and nyaya.
Okay.
So niti is about the rules, the procedures, the institutions themselves having fair rules, proper processes. Think of it like the rule book for the game. A lot of Western philosophy, Sen argues, kind of gets focused heavily on perfecting this niti, the rule book. But nyaya, on the other hand, is about, well, the actual outcomes, what happens in society, the lives people are actually able to live. It's about realized justice, the result of the game, not just the rules. And Sen really champions Nyaya.
Okay. So it's like you can have the fairest rule book imaginable, Needy, but if the game still plays out in a way that leaves lots of people suffering, Nia, then you haven't really achieved justice in a meaningful sense.
Exactly. It's about the reality on the ground. And to show why just focusing on perfect rules or single principles is so hard, he tells this great little story, the flute parable. Hey, picture this. There are three kids, Anne, Bob, and Carla, and just one flute. They're arguing over who should get it. Anne says, I should get it because I'm the only one who can actually play it well. She'll get the most utility, the most enjoyment out of it. That's kind of a utilitarian argument, right? Then Bob says, hold on, I should get it because I'm the poorest. I don't have any other toys. That's an egalitarian argument, focus on need and equality. And then Carla steps up and says, well, actually, I should get it because I made the flute. That's a libertarian kind of argument, right? About the right to the fruits of your own labor. Now, the point is, all three have really strong, reasonable, ethical claims. Anne's claim makes sense, Bob's claim makes sense, Carla's claim makes sense, but they conflict. Sen calls this plural grounding. There isn't just one single principle of justice that everyone agrees on or that automatically wins. Different, perfectly reasonable values can point in different directions. And this, he says, shows why trying to find the single perfect solution, the transcendental answer, is often just futile. Reasonable people can reasonably disagree based on different valid principles.
Right, right. And that just, it really shows you the problem in miniature, doesn't it? You have these competing valid claims and no easy formula tells you which one is correct. So if we accept that disagreement is kind of baked in, how does his comparative approach actually help us? What tools does he suggest we use to make things better when we can't agree on perfect?
Okay, so he offers a couple of really key tools here. The first is the idea of public reasoning. This is central for Sen. He argues that the real value of democracy isn't just, you know, voting. It's democracy's role as a space for open, inclusive, reasoned public discussion. It's about debate, argument, listening to dissent, having a free press, all of that. He makes this incredibly powerful point. No major famine has ever occurred in a functioning democracy with a relatively free press.
Wow.
Yeah. It's not a coincidence, he argues. That public scrutiny, that ability for people to voice concerns and hold power accountable, it prevents the worst kinds of injustices. The second tool is open impartiality. This is a bit different from Rawls' famous veil of ignorance, where you imagine choosing principles without knowing your own position within a society. Sen prefers Adam Smith's idea of the impartial spectator. This encourages us to step outside our own immediate group, our own society, and consider perspectives from elsewhere, maybe even globally. It's about deliberately trying to counteract our own biases, our own parochial viewpoints.
I like that, the impartial spectator.
Yeah.
It feels more active somehow. Like you have to consciously try and see things from an outside perspective, maybe even a global one, to get a richer sense of what's fair. How does that broader view connect to what many see as his biggest contribution, the capabilities approach?
Yeah, it connects very directly. Because the capabilities approach is fundamentally about understanding what people are actually able to do and to be, you know, in their real lives within that wider world context. So
yeah.
Instead of just measuring justice by looking at resources like how much income someone has or even just asking about their subjective happiness, which can be tricky, right?
Yeah.
People might adapt to deprivation and say they're happy.
Right. The adaptive preferences thing.
Exactly. Instead of those, the capabilities approach focuses on, well, capabilities. Yeah. These are people's effective opportunities, their real freedoms to achieve the kinds of lives they have reason to value. What can they actually do? What can they actually be? So think about it. A pregnant woman or someone with a disability might need a lot more resources than someone else to achieve the same basic capability, like being well-nourished or being mobile. It's about the substantive freedom people have, not just the means or the reported feeling.
Okay, so it's really about, are people genuinely free and equipped to live lives they value, recognizing that just giving everyone the same stuff might not actually create equal opportunity or well-being? That feels... Yeah, very practical, very human-centered. So taking all this theory, the comparative approach, public reasoning, capability, how does it actually play out? How can we use these ideas in the real world, like in policy or even just in how we think about things?
Well, the applications are pretty wide-ranging. In policymaking, for instance, it pushes us to evaluate policies not just by, say, GDP growth, but by how much they actually expand people's capabilities, access to decent healthcare, good education, political voice, things like that. In fact, the UN's Human Development Index, which tries to measure well-being more broadly than just income, was heavily influenced by Sen's work on capabilities. Then you see it in social activism, too. It helps activists focus on manifest injustices, the really obvious ones, and articulate exactly how they restrict people's capabilities. So advocating for wheelchair ramps isn't just about some abstract fairness. It's about the concrete capability of mobility, of participation in society, even on a personal level. Using that impartial spectator idea can help us think about how our own choices might affect others, maybe people far away, broadening our sense of responsibility. And in things like international negotiations, say on climate change or pandemics, it suggests maybe we should focus less on arguing about the perfect global treaty and more on finding comparative steps in committal improvements that actually reduce harm and injustice now.
Yeah, that really, it makes it feel less abstract, more empowering somehow. Like, you don't have to wait for the grand solution. You can look for opportunities to make a tangible difference everywhere.
Exactly. I think if you boil it down, the really big lessons from Sen are maybe threefold. First, and this is huge, we can make real progress on justice without waiting for universal agreement on perfection. That frees us up from deadlock. Second, the vital importance of listening to diverse voices, diverse perspectives, including global ones, using that public reasoning and open impartiality to avoid blind spots. And third, the capabilities approach gives us this much richer, more humane way to think about what well-being actually means, beyond just money or simple happiness metrics. It's really a series of shifts, isn't it? From perfect ideals to comparative improvements, from just looking at institutions to looking at actual lives, from a narrow view to a more global one. Justice becomes less of a fixed endpoint and more of an ongoing process, you know, a constant effort to reduce identifiable injustices.
That feels like a really powerful and honestly, quite hopeful way to think about it. It makes tackling injustice seem less overwhelming. So as we wrap up this deep dive, maybe something for you, the listener, to think about. Consider a specific injustice, maybe something you see in your own community or something bigger in the world. How could you apply Sen's idea of realization-focused comparison? How could you argue for a concrete improvement, even if you know you can't get everyone to agree on what the perfect fix would look like? Just a thought to carry with you. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into Amartya Sen's The Idea of Justice. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.